following Cappuccino podcast may be distressing for some listeners. It mentions suicide, suicide prevention, as well as mental health issues. Helpline services are available right now in New Zealand that offer support and information and help for you, your parents, family, whānau, and friends. All the services I'm about to mention are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If you need to talk, free call or text 1737 anytime for support from a trained counsellor. Lifeline at 0800 543 354 or free text 4357. Youthline 0800 376 633 or free text 234. Samaritans 0800 726 666. Suicide Helpline 0508 828 865 or Healthline 0800 611 116. Please reach out. You are valued. You are important.
The Cappuccino podcast brought to you in association with Tactical Solutions. For all your tactical solutions, check them out at www.tactical.co.nz.
It's that time again, so grab yourself a cup of joe
and get ready for the Cappuccino with Constable Brian.
My very special guest on the Cappuccino podcast today is Sergeant Kevin Briggs, retired from the Californian Highway Patrol. He's the author of The Guardian of the Golden Gate Bridge book. He's a mental health and suicide prevention speaker, famed for his TED Talk. He's also a US Army veteran, and previously he's worked as a correctional officer at both Soledad and St. Quentin State Prison. In 1990, he joined the Californian Highway Patrol and worked on the Golden Gate Bridge. The Golden Gate Bridge, San Francisco, on average, has about 4 to 6 calls for suicidal matters each month. In 1999, Kevin completed training at the CHP Motor School and in 2008 promoted to the rank of Sergeant. He graduated from the FBI Crisis Negotiation course, and one of his roles for the CHP was to train new CHP officers and Golden Gate Bridge staff on crisis intervention and negotiations with suicidal people. In 2013, Kevin retired from the CHP and promotes crisis management leadership skills and suicide prevention worldwide via his company, Pivotal Points. He's a cancer survivor, he's had heart issues, he's been divorced, he suffers from PTSD as well as depression. Over 200 people have received Sergeant Kevin Briggs' help while they've been on the bridge. My very special pleasure and honour to introduce Kevin Briggs to the Cappuccino podcast. Kevin, the first thing we do on the Cappuccino podcast is we do a thing called the Speed Round, dedicated to what I believe is the world's greatest police movie, Speed, with Keanu Reeves in it. Maximum Speed. He's Neo. He's Bill and Ted. He's John Wick. So I'm going to ask you 7 quick fire random questions. Anything that comes into your head as your first answer counts. So the first question I'm going to ask you is, the last book that you read was what, Kevin?
I have it. It was a book on emotions.
There we go.
And I can't remember the name, but I got it right in my other room here.
Hey, that's all good. No problems. What, in your opinion, is the best police movie of all time?
Ooh, I'm going to go with Clint Eastwood, Dirty Harry, one of his shows.
Excellent. I thought you might go Bullet with San Francisco, but hey, look, that's all good. No problems. What's one material thing that you cannot live without?
I would say non-living would probably be my coffee.
Bless. There's a man after my own heart. Now, normally when we do the Cappuccino, I'd actually turn up in my squad car, given the fact that there's a huge ocean in between us, actually a couple of oceans. I can't do that today. But if I was to order your coffee, what would your coffee order be?
Just a regular cup of joe, cup of coffee with some cream or milk in it. That's it.
There you go.
You may call it flat white, maybe.
What's the best music concert you've ever been to, in your opinion?
I would go with, that I've been to, would probably be Night Ranger.
Good work. Dinner for 6. No family members allowed, but any 6 people you would like at your dinner table from history, who would you choose?
I would choose Caesar, Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, Jesus, not in this order, and Napoleon for the history, and then Aristotle.
There you go. That's certainly going to be an interesting conversation. And the last one is, who was your childhood idol? Did you have a childhood idol?
when I was very, very, very young, was probably something like Speed Racer. Something.
There you go.
It was a cartoon out here.
Great stuff. All good. All right. So let's start at the very beginning, Kevin, because you have a life of service to others. You're still continuing with that life. Where do you think that drive comes from? Is that from your mother, your father?
I think it's from things that have happened to me besides the genetic factor of from my mother and father. But I think a lot of it's things that have happened to me mm-hmm. along the way, which I'm happy to discuss, that I see that in other people.
Yeah.
And I just wish they could get some help.
So in 1981, you go and join the U.S. Army, but at the same time, you're only there for a wee while before you find that you've got testicular cancer. You have lymph nodes removed. You have chemotherapy. You get depression. How did you cope with that as a 21-year-old? I mean, that's almost a podcast. It's in its entirety right there, let's be honest, right? Right. But I'm going to ask you this. So one, how did you cope? Two, what was the greatest lesson you learned? And three, what advice would you give to somebody or a young person who was in that same situation now?
So I coped having a very, very good support system, which I didn't even realize that these folks came together during that time. Mm-hmm. This is, of course, a long time ago, 1983.
Mm-hmm.
And then as far as what I have learned something about it, if I could pass that along to somebody that age, make sure you get checked. Don't think it's a joke. It's brutal. At least mm-hmm. people are living through it now. Back when I had this in 1983, they told me back then, 10 years prior, man, you may not make it through it. So be sure to check yourself. You know, it sounds funny and it's a horrible thing, testicular cancer, but a lot of people are getting it as many other cancers are on the rampage now.
Mm-hmm.
Check yourself and don't feel any shame or bashfulness about it if you feel a lump or something on your testicle.
Yeah, exactly. And as you say, and I'm going to say it again as well, just so that people are listening to this podcast, please self-check, gentlemen. And if you do have an issue, a lump or something that feels strange, make sure you get to your doctor straight away. So after you've done a little bit of time in the Army and you have your issue there with cancer, you turn to the corrections department. Do you think that's where you have become such a great reader and of humans and also a listener as well? Because when we start talking about your role in the CHP, clearly you've got an affinity with listening and being able to read people. Do you think that's where it started?
I think so. I really do. And I was looking for a job and it was recommended, hey, why don't you try this for law enforcement and corrections? So I was accepted and worked at Soledad State Prison for 1 year and San Quentin State Prison for 2 years. And, you know, you're down there with the inmates and you're vastly outnumbered and you have no weapons. You don't have a gun. So you rely on your wits and the what you build, the trust and the faith with these individuals. Now, mind you, we're not buddies. We're not friends, but we get along. We have to be able to get along. So you need to have a trust with those folks, too, because, you know, they could easily gang up on you and mm-hmm. and. People who work in corrections have seen that, to where officers have been, you know, stuck with a shank or whatever they want to call it. And it's very, very brutal and very fast. So I think by helping that, and you're not just a wash away type of person, you're there to do a job, but you don't have to antagonize these individuals and be on them 24 hours a day either.
No, you're not wrong. As one of my friends would say, you have a very good spidey sense. You once had an encounter with a Charles Manson as well, who happened to be in a cell as you were moving another prisoner. That's correct, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Quite the character, he
was. Yes. Yeah. Who at the end of your conversation actually threatened to cut off your head, if that's correct, according to your book.
He did.
Yeah. Having that had that brief little conversation with him, did you see how easily people could be have been influenced by him?
100%. He would just look at you right in your eyes, and it was like there's nobody else in the world but you two. And he just hit subject to subject to subject to subject, way vastly different subjects. And he's changing without even a big breath. Just boom, 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 boom. So, you know, if he was in his right mental capacity and was out for good, I think he really could have been a hell of a leader.
Yeah. So then in 1990, you joined the Californian Highway Patrol. I have to say, as a police officer, one of my dream jobs, which is strange because I can't ride a motorbike, but we'll talk about that in a second. I do have to ask though, what made you join the Californian Highway Patrol and not something like the San Francisco Police or LA Police or anything else like that?
So I like being specialized. And when I'm looking off through the penal code, and we have a ton of rules and laws out here,
yeah.
You know, talked about way back then, talked about $400 worth of olives and all these weird things that they don't even do anyways. But I think, but I want to be specialized, like corrections, it's specialized. So I thought, hey, I want to look at it at the Highway Patrol. But I really wasn't going to do it until a friend of mine who I'm working with at San Quentin said, hey, I'm going out for the Highway Patrol. Come and do it with me. And he kept bugging me and bugging me and bugging me. All right, I'm going to do it. So I went full bore in. I said, you know, I'm giving up everything to study and do what I can to get through this. And I made it. And he didn't, unfortunately. But he's about 75% of the reason I went in, because he pushed me to go with him.
That's all good. Now, I've got to ask the question, because I very often get asked by people, what's part of the reason you joined the police? And I say to them, I have to be honest, it was because of 7 Mary 3 and 7 Mary 4. And yes, I can see from your eye roll exactly you know who I'm talking about. Perhaps the Californian Highways Patrol's most famous call signs of all time. Was that any influence or any sway in your decision-making process?
You know, it wasn't. But when I got onto the bikes, onto the motorcycles afterwards, I would hear that quite frequently traveling down to the Golden Gate Bridge, because that's still shown around the world. And people would come up from around the world. Hey, they go, Ponch and John, it's Chips. And I heard that so many times.
Yeah, I bet.
And they'd ask me, which one are you? Who do you want me to be today?
Now, I'm guessing, and like you say, you hear it all the time, with the CHP officers, and I've stood down one end of the Golden Gate Bridge and had my photo taken with a CHP officer before. That Chips angle, is it something that the CHP officers just tolerate? Is it an eye roll, or is it like, yeah, okay, let's just get this over and done with?
It depends on the person. I took it, hey, if you know about what we do. Now, mind you, the show is quite different from reality.
Yeah, exactly.
But still, if it gave a positive image, of the Highway Patrol, then fantastic. Yeah.
And still on repeat all around the world as well. Just bizarre. So after a 4-year stint in the Hayward East area, you start working on the, and I'm going to get the name probably incorrect. Is it the Marin area?
Marin.
It's Marin.
Marin.
Yep. Yes. No worries. I only have only ever traveled by boat underneath it and around it. So that's all good. You start working on the Golden Gate Bridge, which I have to say, as a tourist and a big San Francisco Giants fan, I've been to twice, and I've never actually thought once about the number of suicides that could be happening on the bridge up above me or as I've walked on the bridge. But since the bridge opened in 1937, there's been over 1,700 people leap to their deaths. And according to the Marin County Office, I should say, there are about 2 to 3 deaths every month. When you first got assigned there, was it even a thought in your head, or did you just think, you know what, I'm going to get this great, I've got the Golden Gate Bridge, it's a great tourist destination where I'll be policing. This is all just going to be sort of sunshine and rainbows and maybe the odd vehicle collision.
Well, I wanted to work down there because I would meet people from all around the world, and it was just, it looked like a pretty cool place. And it actually is. It's a very cold place compared to the rest of Marin County.
Yeah.
When it's across that bridge, it's in Marin County. But also, a lot of officers did not want to work down there. And I didn't understand why until I started working down there.
Yeah, I bet. And really foggy as well. Both times I've been there, I couldn't believe it. I was standing on the Golden Gate Bridge and I couldn't see more than probably 2 or 3 meters in front of me, which was quite surprising.
Summer, June, July, and August.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know it well. So the research shows that when a person survives a suicide attempt, or they can be prevented from one altogether, they often don't go on to attempt it again, which is where Kevin and fellow California Highway Patrol officers have shined. As I said last night on a social media post, I don't think exponentially you could actually measure what Kevin has done for humanity. He has been responsible, or partly responsible, for listening or talking to over 200 people and getting them to step back over the rail. When people say that about you, Kevin, and I know that you go worldwide and you talk about this type of thing all the time, do you feel a sense of pride? I know that you have only lost, I think, 2 people who have actually stepped over the rail while you've been there. Do you feel sorrow at the people you can't help? Is it a mixture of emotions for you or not?
It's a mixture, because anytime they bring up the Golden Gate Bridge, it's for me, some things you may not know that I can talk about, but
Yeah.
I've had some various traumatic instances. So my brain tends to be on the negative side a lot. So if they say the Golden Gate Bridge, then I think, all right, there's the folks that I lost, and I see them. But I handled 4 to 6 cases a month for almost 10 years or so. So that turns out to be a lot of people, you know. But there's a lot of folks that, and I don't use the word save, I say I helped, you know. So I helped folks. I want them to make that decision, if they're over the rail, to come back over the rail on their own, because I think it takes so much courage to not only go over that rail first, but imagine the amount of courage it takes to come back. So I like that I played a part in helping them to do that.
Now, often in podcasts like this, and I know that you do podcasts quite a bit, and you also publicly speak as well, we're asking you to relive some of the most horrific scenes and events. And I know as a police officer of 28 years, very often I either get tired of telling the story, I just have one of those days where I can't be bothered. Or I think, actually, there's some good in this. If I share my stories, then other people are going to learn. How do you cope with that on a day-to-day basis? Because you now have your own private company where you're out talking. But how do you actually cope with the emotional unloading at the end of the day?
I really try to focus on those that I was able to assist, that I spoke to, and they did come back over. Because if I looked at the few that I did lose, and although I want to say, you know, two folks out there in law enforcement and first responders and anybody else thinking of this line of work, they make that decision to jump, but they make it with an unhealthy brain also. So yes, we're going to blame ourselves. What could we have done different? You know, if anything, probably nothing. But they made the decision, but they did it with an unhealthy brain. It's just crappy all the way around for everybody. But we try to think also, and this may sound a little egotistical, and I preach against having an ego coming into this work, is if you're not going to do it, who is? We need folks out there as negotiators that want to do this work, because it takes a toll on you, and it's very tiring.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Now, as you stated before, you've had your own mental health battles, clearly with all the work that you did for the CHP and corrections and military and everything else, as well as having your cancer at the early age. You've suffered a little bit from you've suffered from depression yourself, amongst other things. How do you now maintain your own mental health on a day-to-day basis? Do you go for a long walk, or do you exercise, or what does it look like?
Well, I should be exercising. Everybody tells me I should be. I don't do much that anymore. I like doing my own work, you know, as such as this, talking about things. I have a great group of guys, 3 to 4 guys that I meet up with about 4 times a week at a local coffee shop. And that gets me out of the house, because those of us who suffer, a lot of times we have a hard time just getting out of the house. If we can get out of that house just to do a walk on our own, or walk the dog, or get somewhere where we chat, I go out 4 times a week or so and have coffee with these guys, and we talk about everything, you know, hunting, fishing, cars, whatever. That is huge for folks to be able to get out and talk. So I'm a big advocate of support groups.
Most definitely. Now, Ken Holmes, who you know very well, I'm going to guess from the Coroner's County's office. I was reading an interview with him the other day. In 2007, released a report on 206 deaths from the Golden Gate Bridge between the period of 1997 and 2007. In it, he said that a majority of the people that jumped were white, male, between the ages of 14 and 44, and the most common sort of occupation of those people was a student. Now, as we both know, Sergeant, you can't just rely on that when you're out on patrol. You can't spot people who are white male students. So what were some of the, and I know that you mentioned this in your book, and I encourage everybody listening to this podcast, go and buy Kevin's book. This podcast is going to be a very cheap imitation of probably one of the best law enforcement books I've ever read. But what were some of the telltale signs that you got really good at spotting people who were going to step over the rail, as you say?
Most of the time, and kind of the obvious one, is a solo, a person by themselves, and not just walking either direction, north or south on the bridge, but maybe going back and forth for a while, maybe going up on the bridge for a bit, coming back and going into their car, and then going back up on the bridge. there's cameras all over. So we have some a group of folks who monitor these cameras, and they'll say, hey, we've watched this individual do this. Can you go have a chat with them? You know, that maybe taking a picture of both sides of the sidewalk. I've had an individual do that because they wanted to show nobody's around them when they were going over the rail. So little things that we spot most of the time, the vast majority of time, it is someone that's solo. You watch their movements. And I don't like to go up and make direct contact until we have a little bit more than just watching them walk on the bridge. I want to see what have they been doing for a bit. Because people, you know, for the most part, don't want to be bothered. They want to be left alone.
Yeah.
Now, if I'm just working my way down on my motorcycle, stopping every 20 feet, saying hi to folks, hey, how are you? This and that. Another story. Yes.
Yeah. Was there anybody that you actually spotted long before they went over the rail that when you went to speak to them went, actually, I've been thinking about this?
Yes. And that's fantastic because we get them before they go over.
Yeah.
That's, you know, and that way it's just a lot easier generally. Mm. We've had some folks that when we're talking to them, they try to go over and now it's a wrestling match on the sidewalk and we don't want to get involved in anything like that.
No.
But if we can talk to them before they, really, we'd like to get to them before they even get on the bridge walking. If they're driving up and we can talk to them in their car or something like that, it'd be even better.
Yeah, ideal. Now, I looked at various studies and there's a long history of deaths in the Golden Gate Bridge. And in 2005, 2008, Mel Blaustein, the then chief psychiatrist at the St. Francis Memorial Hospital, asked a large number of individuals who had either been brought into the hospital or attempted to harm themselves. And one of the varying reasons was, and you shattered this myth in your book as well, that that's a very sort of romantic setting, the Golden Gate Bridge, in which somebody is going to take their lives. It's anything but that, isn't it, if we're completely honest?
It is. You're about 220 feet up in the air. Should you decide to take that leap, it's a 4 to 5 or so second fall, you know, 220 feet down. And you mentioned Ken Holmes. I was talking to him and he said, you know, you hit at about 75 miles an hour. Very few people that hit that will survive that. Very, very few. I have seen people jump and hit the water. And then all you see is this big splash of white foam. And this is, you know, this is a tough subject. This is hard to even talk about. But
yeah,
when they do come back up, a lot of times they are so broken up. Their arms are broken or they have punctures from their ribs hitting vital organs that then they drown. Mm. It is not an easy way to go. It's a horrible way to go. But people think it's quick and easy and it'll get the job done. Well, more than likely, it'll get the job done. But you're probably going to suffer also.
Yeah. Yeah, not wrong. Now, in your book, The Guardian of the Golden Gate, I was staggered at the number of people who actually didn't land in the water when they leapt from the bridge. Many perish in the valleys by the bridge. How do officers or attending staff cope with such incidences after the incident? So after you've removed the departed and you've notified family members and everything else, there's got to be that lull when you get back into the station. And everybody's like, oh, it's another one for this month. How did your staff members deal with it? And as a supervisor, how did you deal with that when you're driving home? Because as we all know, that can be one of the worst times for a cop. You're driving home, you've got your own thoughts. You think, yeah, I'm going to go home and everybody's going to be smiling and happy and everybody else. And they're going to ask me, what did I do today at work? And you're going to say, oh, nothing. It was just an average day.
Yeah. Yeah. Fortunately, unfortunately for me, I've been with my girlfriend for 20 years now, and she's a sergeant on the patrol. So she would kind of understand what I was going through if I didn't say anything. And I'm not very good at hiding my emotions. I kind of suck at it.
Yeah.
But she would probably even know the radio call. But I try to think if I lose one, you know, how many folks have I helped? And, you know, I keep avoiding that word saved. It bumps me up some, and I want that is how many folks have we helped? And that's what I share with officers. I've had one female officer that I was working with, she lost an individual who she had been talking to for some time, a young Asian woman, and she was escorting her off the bridge. She didn't have enough to detain her. And the young woman just leaped over and boom, and she hit land. And this just wrecked the female officer. She was a mess. And I told her to go home. She didn't want to go home. She wanted to stay and work. But eventually, you know, she did get some assistance. We have the what's called the Employee Assistance Program out here. And mm-hmm. You can see a counselor, trained counselor, 7 times per fiscal year. And she went and did that. years and years and years ago when I first started, you would never even think about something like that. You see whatever you see, you go home or you go to a bar, you come back and you do it all again the next day and no word said, you just do it. Nowadays, we're realizing that's not good. So if we give these officers time to go out and talk about this and go through the emotions that they're going through, they come back stronger and they can help others. So there's no shame in getting help.
No, you're definitely right. And I can remember when I first started those days, you know, you come back to work the next day. Yeah, everything's good. And I think the thing that lots of people forget sometimes is this isn't going to be attend to the incident and then I need to speak to somebody. It might actually be attend the incident and nothing's going to occur to me or happen to me for the next 3, 6, maybe even 9 months. And then I'll see something and it will trigger that incident again off in my mind and things will start to unravel. So again, please, if you do need some help, then make sure that you talk. When you were driving home as a supervisor and it was all calm and quiet and you reflected back on it, what were some of the things that you reflected on, Kevin, as you sort of drove home?
You know, some of the things that I would run into, for instance, a woman in her mid-50s with a friend of hers, they were doing multiple places around the United States. This woman was dying of cancer, of breast cancer, and only had a few months left to live. And they were out to the bridge, and the woman who was suffering had to go use the restroom, but the other woman stayed by me out of the Vista Point that overlooks San Francisco and the bridge, and she told me this. And I said, oh my God, I felt so bad. I go, can I give you a tour? What can I do? Things like that. This woman's dying, and they're out traveling around trying to get these memories and things before she passes. Stuff like this just makes you want to be a better person. Mm-hmm. for folks. You know, she's been long past, but I think if I got a diagnosis like that, how would I be? I'd become, you know, instantly depressed, and I probably wouldn't even leave the house. But this lady's out, and they're celebrating her life while she's still alive.
You might need to make a return trip back to New Zealand if it happened.
Oh, I'd love to.
There you go. Hello. Now, as you walk across one of the most beautiful bridges and bays in the world, there are reminders of the bridge on the bridge and the surrounding areas itself. I've seen them myself. 24/7 text line notes. There's phones. There's surveillance notices. When you started in the Bay Area, Kevin, was that the case, or was it a bit of a sort of taboo subject? As you mentioned in the book, I think it's one of the chapters you have in the book is called The Dark Side of the Bridge. Was it just sort of a hidden secret amongst people?
It was, really. You didn't talk about it. And we would, like at the time, prior to 9/11, here, the tragedy in 9/11, mm-hmm. in the States, there was just one officer working that bridge, going down all the way into San Francisco, and then up over the hill into Sausalito area. If the folks ever want to see this, there's a tunnel now. It's now called the Robin Williams Tunnel, but it was a big area. It was not just the bridge. Mm-hmm. So for one officer, it was a lot of area to cover. And it's not just the suicides. That's a small but very significant portion of what we do. But I would handle 4 to 6 cases a month. And we would either get folks, like I said, in a parking lot, or over the rail or on the sidewalk. But in talking with these folks, you know, it was just amazing what you would discover and the commonalities of all that. But it was really something to know that you were out there and there was nobody else around. My beat partner would very seldom ever come down. So, you know, you want to try to get as do this as best as a craft as you can and learn from everyone and everything that you can to do this.
Mm. Now, when you're talking about talking to people who are over the rail or on the bridge, one of the things I remember the most about the Golden Gate Bridge is, and as you well know, we get those lovely panoramic shots of the Golden Gate Bridge and the Bay Area, and it looks incredible, and it is. But actually stepping onto the Golden Gate Bridge itself when the traffic's at sort of peak hour, it's incredibly, incredibly noisy there on the bridge. Is it very difficult to talk to somebody with all that noise going on? I know that you have, and this is an absolute tragedy, that you do have people driving past, you know, yelling at people to jump and the such like, but is it really difficult to communicate with them?
It's horrible. It's a horrible place to have a conversation. It's hard to have a conversation when you're with friends and you're just walking down the sidewalk. So to have somebody on that rail or even on the sidewalk talking to them, like you said, it's very windy most of the time. It's very loud. We may stop one lane of traffic to put a patrol car there, Otherwise, there's six lanes of traffic. We don't stop those. And if someone is over the rail, most of the folks nowadays that commute understand what's going on. They see the police presence. Traffic starts to all back up. They may get annoyed. And we have had it, and I've had it happen to me, to where somebody will roll down their window because they're a couple minutes late getting home, and they yell out, "Jump, you SOB," or something simple. So now that individual over the rail goes, "You know what? I told you nobody loves me. Nobody cares." And now there goes any kind of rapport I was doing. But it is a terrible place to have a conversation. It really is. It's cold. It's nasty.
Yeah.
It's just like ice. Yeah, it's not a great place to conduct an interview or any kind of conversation.
No, when I was looking at some of the pictures in your book and reading some of the stories, so how could he be talking with that constant but I'm going through the Golden Gate? But hey, look, when you move to the Bay Area, and we know that it was a different time and a different era, specifically the bridge area, what mental health training had you actually done as a CHP officer? I know that when I joined the New Zealand Police, for instance, in 1996, despite the fact I only looked 22, Kevin, we got if we were very lucky, I think it was probably maybe 3.5 to 4 days of mental health training. And it was a very, very big, broad paintbrush that went over a number of conditions and diagnoses and everything else. And if we're honest, it was the best that we could do at the time. But did you actually receive any mental health training?
Not when I first started. There was zero. I didn't know what I was stepping into at all. I had no idea what I was doing. It wasn't until a few years later when I went through crisis intervention team training that a lot of officers are going through now, CIT. And then way towards the end of my career, when I went through the FBI crisis negotiator school, which should have been done way before that.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's not fair to me. That's not fair to the people I'm talking to.
No.
It is getting better. I think we still have work to do, but it is getting better.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that work to do as well. When was the light bulb moment for you when you realized, you know what, I better start reading a little bit more about this and getting some tools to help me and others? Because as police officers so very often do, you know, we turn up for an incident, we get to about another 3 or 4 incidents, and it's like, this is actually becoming a bit of an issue for me. I need to do some extracurricular stuff. So when was that light bulb moment for you?
That was right after the very first woman that I spoke to that was over the rail. When I'm riding down there, I'm thinking, I don't know what I'm doing. How do I approach? What's the first thing to say? I didn't have a clue. It was terrible. And I was very angry at the highway patrol for putting me in this situation.
And I know that one of your, I'm surprised you haven't trademarked it, but one of your sort of sayings is, "How's your tomorrow looking?" Which I have to be honest, I've started kind of using here as well. It's gets a great reaction because I think people are stuck in the present. And like you say, you know, how's tomorrow looking? And they sort of stop and go, oh yeah, okay, cool. So when you started getting those tools and learning about stuff from that very first jump, was it a big exponential curve? Because now when you type in the name Kevin Briggs, you do see it, and I completely agree. This man has the equivalent to a PhD in suicide intervention, has been mentioned by others. Was it a big learning curve, or was it something that you just gradually got better at as you went through those horrific experiences?
It was a big learning curve because, you know, there's just that person. And if that person goes, there's no one to take their place. It's not a copycat.
No.
So I need my A game right here, right now. And if I don't have that training, there's only so much I can bring with my empathy and what I have learned along the way, so to speak. But I had a lot to learn, and I pretty much learned on the backs of those I spoke with. And I would ask every single person that I spoke to at the end of this, usually, you know, what did I do that helped this situation? And what did I do that maybe wasn't so good that hurt the situation?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I learned a lot that way.
Now, the officers in the Bridge Security Department officers now complete an average of 80 hours in crisis intervention and de-escalation training. You've done the FBI crisis training, like you said. Is 80 hours, in your opinion, too much, too little? Or let's put it this way. If I made you the governor of California, how long would you be training people for on an unlimited budget? How long would you train them for, Kevin?
80 hours is good if you get the right people in there that want to do this job. If you're voluntold to do it, you're not going to catch it. You're going to be probably texting or playing a game on your phone. You have to get the right people who want to do this type of work. And that's where you're going to get people who want to be there, who want to participate. and learn. And those are the ones who are really going to make a difference.
So if somebody has a friend or is contacted by somebody saying the equivalent things to, well, it's not going well for me, or I've had enough, because I know that somebody will ask this if I don't ask you in this the podcast, what would you suggest that they did? So if somebody was contacted by a friend by a text or by a phone and said, actually, you know what, I've had enough, things are getting too hard, what would be your suggestion to them?
If it was a friend, an acquaintance, I'd say, can we meet somewhere? And I like to meet that individual where they're comfortable. I don't want to go to a coffee shop, because then you're out in the open. Other people may hear what's going on, and that individual is not allowed to break down, so to speak. They're going to want to keep this macho face going on if it's a guy. So I would say go where they are comfortable and have a conversation. Hey, what's been going on? Or maybe I've seen a couple of things. Yeah, I saw this and I saw this. I want to let you know I'm here for you. I'm here for you 24 hours a day. You can call me. If I can't pick up right then, I will get back with you as soon as I can. Whatever you're going through, you do not have to go through this alone. And then normalize their situation. I'm very, very big into normalization. Talking about a subject that anybody going through these different aspects of that may be thinking about when we're talking about suicide, maybe thinking about suicide. Hi, Bob. You know, man, you're going through a divorce. You're looking at losing your house. Yeah, I know you're in some trouble at work and your vehicle broke down and your dog died and all these different things. I go, brother, anybody going through all of that might be thinking about suicide. Have you been thinking about suicide? And just give it a pause. People get worried. They get anxious and they say, everything's going to be okay. I know you, Bob. You're tough. You're going to handle it all. No, we don't say that. There's some things we don't say, but give a pause and let them answer. Well, it did cross my mind. Well, how do you feel about that? That's something you are serious about. How long have you been thinking about it? You know, have you tried something? Well, yeah, you know, 2 years ago, I did put a belt around my neck. Well, what stopped you? I couldn't do this to my kids. There you go. We have what's in the negotiator's world called hooks. And that's a great hook. Your kids. Okay, let's talk about that. And I want them to see those emotions and feel those emotions. But if it comes down to it and you think they're going to do it, don't be afraid to call for help.
No. And that was one of the big things I got out of your book, was that ability to listen and the connectivity that you, like you say, you call it a hook. That was, you have to get that hook in fairly quickly, don't you?
It could take a little. If you already know the person, then you can go stepped above. Yes.
Yeah.
But if you don't know the person, it's all about stretching that time out, using our active listening skills to establish that rapport. And I just use my first name. And I ask folks, you know, my name's Kevin. Is it okay if I come up and talk with you for a while? It's different than what we are basically taught as police officers, to go in and calm the chaos right now.
Yeah.
This, I'm going to stay back. I want to let them make some of the shots. Always keeping officer safety in mind, of course. But let them call some of the shots. Yeah, it's okay. You can come up right here. I don't want you going anywhere from there. You're gonna stay 5 foot back. No problem. I'll stay right here and chat. Like I said, my name's Kevin. Can I get your name? And if they allow me to use their first name, I'm going to personalize everything. And now we start to develop that rapport. And it may take some time. You don't know.
So somewhere in all of your Bay experiences, you start to get known as the Guardian, which I've got to be honest, sounds like a good name for a Marvel superhero movie. Now, if we've got to be honest, most police officers, we don't like attention. And we certainly don't like what we'd call in New Zealand flashy nicknames like the Guardian. And I know that you even had a baseball card printed with the Guardian on it. Did that nickname, and that's completely appropriate as well, I believe, but A, did it add more pressure on you when people started saying, here comes the Guardian type stuff? And did you find it at all awkward when people started referring to you as sort of the Guardian of the Golden Gate Bridge?
Yes, absolutely. I'm not a big fan of it, because I think there's guardians of many Golden Gates, whether that Golden Gate is your home or you're at a school working in the schools, whatever that may be. So the Guardian of the Golden Gate, I don't really like, even though that's part of the name of the book. But that does help. That was up to the publisher, to what he wants to sell books. That's what they do. Everything you said is correct. I'm not very hip with it. If it helps bring attention to suicide awareness, then that's fine. But hey, it's the Guardian of the Golden Gate. And especially when I was still working with IRBTOL, Woo, boy, that I
Yeah.
got a lot of grief on that one.
Yeah, I bet. And what's and I bet there'd be a number of incidences where you'd be turning up and everybody be like, "Hey, Kevin's here. We can sort of take a couple of steps back, and he's going to work his magic." Was that difficult to sort of work as a supervisor with that happening?
No, I wanted the young people to get out there and do that. And I never want to see somebody over the rail or coming up to that bridge, to think about suicide. But if it's there, we have to work it. So I wanted the young officers to go do it, knowing that I was going to retire. And, there's other folks that do the same work that I do. And when I was up there after the tragedy of 9/11 in the United States, the bombings and all, we added some more officers down there. So if I couldn't make a connection with an individual, I would call somebody else and have them try, because we have to remember in this line of work in negotiations, it's not about us. It is always about that individual. So I was happy to pass this off. And maybe they may have something that I haven't tried before that I can learn. But if I'm making that connection, then I'm going to handle it.
Yeah, not wrong. So I could probably, in all honesty, spend a week discussing you and some of your incredible experiences in the book, some of which were horrific, some of which I found heartwarming, and others which I have to say, and it doesn't very often happen, as a cop of 28 years, sent complete and utter chills up my spine. When you think of your experiences on the bridge, what do you think some of your greatest and greatest observations and learnings are from that period in your life?
I met so many nice people down there just while on patrol and hanging out in some of the local coffee shops. And also the bridge people, even the iron workers, they're not trained in this, but the caring, sometimes they would get there before we would. The caring and the masterfulness that they would show to folks. I'm like, wow, how does he come up with this stuff? They're a wonder to behold because they've done it a lot. They work down there every day, 8 hours a day. And there's, of course, there's tragedy down there. I've seen some horrific crashes before they put a barrier in the road. But mainly people come there for their birthdays, for anniversaries, to propose. So those are the things I like to really think about there. And then the friendships I built down there with the people in the area.
Did it restore your faith in humanity, or did it make you come away thinking there's still a lot of work we've got to do, especially with suicide awareness, like we've spoken about before? It is a great taboo. People don't speak about it. And when we look at it, 800,000 people, I think it is, a year die from suicide. And if we're honest, a lot of those people are male, and they don't reach out to anybody before they commit the act. So did you walk away with more faith in humanity because you've met wonderful people, or did you think we still have so much more that we could be doing to make this better for everybody?
Absolutely both. As going out and teaching this now and talking to folks, I could see people's eyes light up and thought, I want to do that. I want to volunteer at a crisis hotline, or I want to get involved with law enforcement, or I want to be a mental health professional. So we need, probably every country in the world is lacking mental health services. I know we are greatly. So to get someone inspired to get into that work, and that is a very, very tough line of work because you're talking to folks all day long to do this. I do a lot of my talks to mental health professionals, and one of my biggest topics that I talk about is taking care of yourself. Because yeah, you may not be at the scene and living this, but just by hearing it, you're taking all this in, and how it's told to you, that could be stored in your brain and really wreak havoc.
And you did right as well. I mean, it's that thing, you must talk to people if it starts wreaking havoc. Now, if I said to you before you'd started work in the Bay Area, you're going to be a TED Talk speaker, you will help some 200 people at the Golden Gate Bridge, you'll become a best-selling author and an advocate for suicide awareness and prevention worldwide, what do you think that Sergeant Briggs of the CHP would have said to me on his first day of shift on the Golden Gate Bridge if I told him all of that?
I would get as much money as I could. I'm going to borrow from every bank around and I'm going to put it against you. There's no way. I'm not a public speaker. I don't know what you're talking about. Negotiator, what? Like everything would be absolutely not.
That's what I thought. So when you retired in 2013, what was it like to actually retire? And now, do you still feel sort of in a, and I know that you do because, and we'll talk about it in a second as well, because you've had some suicide prevention devices put on the side of the bridge there. But do you still feel an emotional gravitational sort of pull towards the bridge when you drive over it? Do you still feel sort of a little bit of a, I don't know, an emotional pull towards it?
Depends on the day. I cross it a lot because I have to go to the airport a lot. I fly a lot. So I go out of San Francisco Airport and I have to cross that bridge. And there'll be times when I just look straight ahead at the vehicle in front of me. And I don't know all the, we go by light poles. There's a lot of light poles on the bridge. And we would go by, besides the south and north tower, we would go by a light pole. And I have stories on most of the light poles. Some days I don't want to remember those stories. So I just concentrate on the vehicle ahead of me. And maybe I'll count the lights or, you know, something along, how many bump, 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 bump are we hearing across the bridge? Take my mind away from it. There's a lot of good stories, but the negativity can be overshadowed a lot with me. So yeah. I have to concentrate on something else.
Yeah. And how do you push that negativity away, Kevin? I mean, like you say, when you're having a good day, no problems. I'm following the car to the airport. There's no issues. On a bad day, I'm counting the lampposts, the light poles, and going, yes, I can remember. Yes, I can remember. Yes. How do you push the negativity away?
If it's during that time when I'm down, maybe I'll put on some music that I really like, or I'll put my mind, even though you're driving, you know, into a whole different realm of trying to think of something. Okay, well, this happened here, and this was a really neat event, or out of there altogether. I have two little chihuahuas that I talk about in my talks for stress relief.
Yeah.
You know, hanging around your dogs, just by hanging out with your dogs can take away a lot of your stress. And I'll think of something funny they did just to get my mind off of that.
Yeah. Now, you travel the world and obviously the United States to promote crisis management, leadership skills, and suicide intervention and prevention. So if I was to make you the worldwide president, we'll just create a brand new department for the world for suicide prevention and awareness. What's five things that most people could do so that we could help, as you would say, help more people?
Take a class in communications, especially active listening skills. Very few people are taught that. So I would go with that for number one.
Mm-hmm.
Take a class in maybe breathing techniques to slow yourself down. I tend to talk way too fast, and I have to really think about slow it down a bit. Because especially when you're talking to somebody in crisis, we're worried and we can panic. And we're like, let me tell you, if you're going to be all right, everything's going to be fine. And I start rambling on, going way too fast. That scares people.
Mm-hmm.
I need to slow down. And then they more than likely will slow down. So that I would get the opportunity to have more people trained in suicide awareness. And there's a lot of different classes out there. I'm still taking classes. Next week, I'll be up in Sacramento for a couple of days. And then I'm going to teach a different sort of class for folks who want to become more aware with suicides and what they can do and what to say and what not to say. So that I get a lot more funding over to get mental health professionals. When my boy was actively suicidal and engaging in non-suicidal self-injury, we went to a mental health professional who was, I gotta say it, he was absolutely horrid. It was terrible. Nice guy, but I don't think he was trained in suicide assessment. You know, if I'm gonna go to I have three stents in my heart, I'm not gonna go to a doctor for something with my heart.
No.
And it's ridiculous, but I saw it. It happened in front of my eyes. We need folks trained for this. So these types of things, and to maybe even have, you know, commercials on the radio and on TV. Hey, there is help out there. You can contact this. So we have numbers, telephone numbers in the United States that you can call or you can text, because we know adolescents a lot of times don't like to talk on the phone, but they'll text. They'll write a paragraph with their thumb just like that.
Yeah.
And my boys are famous for that. They, you know, they won't talk to me on the phone so much, but they'll text me all the time. So different ways of getting folks even more aware about themselves. Hey, when you're going through these things, what are you thinking? And here's some things that we can do to get around that. The breathing techniques, maybe yoga, these things that guys, we a lot of times don't want to do. I started meditation years ago because I don't know if you know this, but I had some very, very severe abuse by a neighbor, which was extremely brutal when I was 8 to 10 years old. And I had some significant nightmares still on occasion because of that. I went through different therapies, and I actually went through what they call a stellate ganglion block injections in my neck to kind of restart my brain a little bit from that. So things like this, a lot of people don't know what's out there. I didn't know this was out there until some folks, because of what I do, they come up to me and said, hey, there's this out there. Maybe you can try this.
Definitely. Speaking of which, and speaking of better communication, you had a motorbike accident that was a life-changing event for you. I did laugh because as Kevin had his motorbike accident and he was driving for the CHP, my first thought was, oh no, they're going to cut off his uniform and especially his boots. And sure enough, there in the book is Kevin saying to his rescuers, please do not cut off my boots. They're going to cost me hundreds of dollars. So cops worldwide, we all thought
Yes.
the same. Yep, not from,
They're
but
expensive. I think they ingrain that into you. It's a two-week school. It's not even a, we call it motor school, but it's not even a school. It's a test from the minute you arrive. It's a horrible place.
It's all about the department budget, let's be honest. But long story short, after as a result of that accident, you find that you've got some issues with your heart that take you, shall we say, a little bit of a long time to communicate to your family because you don't want them to worry, you've just gone through an accident and all that type of stuff. How do we get, and you would probably know better than anybody, how do we get males to communicate health and mental health issues a lot better than they are? Do we start talking to children, and we do this in New Zealand now, but do we start talking to children as young as sort of two, three, four about it's okay to express your emotions? But even if we do that now, we still have probably sector of our community that is probably about 40 years where, like you said, they've got to be big and macho, they can't be too tough, men can't cry, they certainly don't go and see women about problems, that type of stuff. How do we get rid of that stigma for males?
I think you nailed it. We got to start people early because it's once it's ingrained in us, it's hard to get that out. And I was that way for a very, very, very long time until all these things started reoccurring or occurring with me, these nightmares and all these things. I just got tired of it. I waited over 40 years to talk about this abuse. You're not, it's not in the book. You didn't read it in the book. I just had enough. So I think by starting in schools, and we don't have to do a suicide prevention talk when they're 5, 6 years old. Around 8th grade or so, I think we should start digging into this some more. But at least let them know it's all right. This is what happened. And especially for folks who have experience, I cried because of this. This is why I cried. And you know what? I thought people were going to make fun of me and all these things. And nothing like that happened. People surrounded me and they provided me with a support system. This is what I would expect from each and every one of you. Think you can do this? You know, we have to protect one another. But start with ourselves. How are we doing? And it's okay to show your emotions. If we need help, what do we do? You know, you're not going to put out a house fire by yourself. You're going to get a bunch of help. You're going to have the firemen to do it. Sometimes we don't quite understand what is going on with us. It's okay to say, hey, I'm having a tough day or a tough week. Do you have a few minutes?
You're not wrong. So for those maybe who aren't in a good space or they're worried about their own mental health, what would you say to them to sort of say, hey, look, here's maybe the way that we get back on the path, or everybody, like you say, everybody has a bad day. What's some tips that people, ordinary everyday people, and let's be honest, all those people you spoke to on the bridge were ordinary everyday people. They were all either somebody's son, daughter, mother, or father. What's some things that the average ordinary person can do to look after themselves, do you think?
I would like them to look up a crisis safety plan. There's a lot of them out there. It's a list of coping strategies and phone numbers, a written list that they could use when they're not doing well and they think, you know what, I don't want to be here anymore. Look up a crisis safety plan just to see what that is. And it gives folks a lot of a good one will tell you, hey, when I'm not feeling right and when things are going really crappy, what can I do? Well, here's a list of phone numbers that I can call. It's already filled out. You fill it out when you're doing okay. Here's some things I like to do because you may forget when I'm dealing with folks up on the Golden Gate Bridge, a lot of times to me, it's like a horse with blinders on, and I want them to see everything. So maybe I'll throw some things out there to them. I had one gentleman who had nothing. He had had a very, very tough life, but he had a goldfish. And boy, we focused on that goldfish for a long time. And we talked about tomorrow. So with him, I said, brother, who's going to be around? If you decide to go today, who's going to feed your goldfish? And he hadn't thought about that because he didn't see tomorrow. He eventually came back over because of that goldfish. You know, what is important to you? What are your goals? When I talk to my boy, he still suffers. I always want to see if he's going to talk about something in the future. If you have a friend, that you know is struggling, if they go to you, hey, can we meet next Tuesday for coffee? Perfect. They're looking into the future. Mm-hmm. Make sure you make that appointment with them. Or if they don't, then you say, hey, you're going to be around next week? Let's meet for coffee. It gives them something to look forward to, a reason, a purpose, and hope. Sometimes it takes a long time for folks to figure things out.
And like you said at the very beginning of the podcast, sometimes when people do make that choice, that was their choice. There are lots of people who get left behind who, and it can be everybody from family members to potential first responders who are trying to help that person feel survivor's guilt. What would you suggest for them to sort of get through it? Because it's a very tough time, as we both know as police officers. You know, you can sometimes dwell on it, and other times it's sort of, and it's gone. But how did you, and I know that you only had a few incidences for the grace of God, but how did you get yourself through that sort of survivor's guilt?
It will, and this is easy to say, harder to do it. It will get easier with time. Mm-hmm. It will, but I want you to take it. Sometimes we can take it just minute by minute. You know, we have to start getting a good support group. I think it's absolutely critical, because who am I going to talk to when I'm really suffering? If I don't have anybody to talk to, that's going to be very difficult. I can do all the meditation, all the yoga, playing with the dogs, but it's still there. It's not until we can get this out of us and being allowed to vent without somebody telling us, well, you should have done this or you should do that. Even if it's on the phone, really, if you can do, you know, we're doing here with a Zoom. We can do this. Now, it's not as good as in person, but you know what? It's a whole lot better than nothing. It really is. So even if you have these groups where you can get in with one person or multiple people, I'm a big fan of some kind of support group. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, there are new safety measures in place on the Golden Gate Bridge. I know that they've been taking a few years to get there, in the form of, as we would describe them in New Zealand, and I know that there's some big technical term, and I know that you've recently just done a news clip on them on YouTube as well for, I think it was NBC, underneath the actual rail that you're talking about. I know that many have advocated for these. Can you just give us a brief explanation of how it's meant to work and how, for instance, it would have made your role as a first responder a lot easier, potentially?
Yeah, it's a suicide deterrent, and it's a metal or a stainless steel net type material that is about 20 feet down from the sidewalk and extends about 20 feet out. And it's on both sides of the bridge, and it is up currently. And what happens is, with a lot of folks is, and I've seen this happen, is they may be thinking about suicide for a long time, but when they say, you know what, I've had it, this is it, almost 50% of the people will attempt within 20 minutes. There's a study on that, very fascinating study out of Houston, Texas. So this is to help with that, and just anybody who thinks, we've had folks come from, you know, other countries once in a while in other states. This is to help prevent that. But when somebody gets up there, if they're thinking, okay, I can do this, I can do this, I can jump. Well, now you have this barrier you're going to have to get into. And it makes them think. But also, if they decide to jump, which has happened already, jumped into that net, they're going to get hurt. It's stretched pretty taut. It is a steel mesh, marine grade material. So it gives them a chance to think about things too. And since this, just for this year, we've only had maybe two suicides off of that bridge, when typically we're getting significantly more, you know, and we would handle 30, 40 suicides a year. Uh-huh. And then sometimes up to 200 people taken off for a mental health evaluation. Those are all way down.
It's a great thing.
Really good. Yes. Yeah. My thought was, I just hope they don't go somewhere else. You know,
no.
A lot of times people, if they wanted to do it off of that bridge, then they won't. And they'll get some help.
Now, the last question for you, and for those of you that are expecting me to ask Kevin a question about his probably most famous photo, I deliberately haven't in this podcast, Kevin, because I know it's a story you've told many, many times, but I'd actually like people to go out and buy your book as well, so that they can find the story of yourself, and also the gentleman that you spent a number of minutes on the bridge with, and I know that you sometimes work closely together now, which I find remarkable. So I'm not even going to mention his name. I'm just going to say go and buy Kevin's book, go and watch the TED Talks, and that way you'll find, if you Google Kevin's name and the Golden Gate Bridge, it's normally the first photo that comes up. All I can say is you must have been freezing because that day looked fairly cold from where I was, from when I looked at the photo. So, all right.
And that's something else that I do out there is if they're not wearing a jacket, I'm not going to wear a jacket. I want to feel what they're feeling. I think that's important.
Yeah, and that was one of the other things I noticed as well, is that when people were feeling cold, the officers there would give them their jackets so that they could stay warm. And as you said, it's all about that connectivity because you're keeping them warm. And if you're keeping them warm, then they're thinking about the future.
And somebody cares.
Yeah, exactly right. So last question for you then, Kevin, is a question I always used to ask our podcast guests, but I thought it was particularly apt for you. So the day of reckoning has come for you. And you are lying in your casket. But strangely enough, you can hear what other people are saying about Sergeant Kevin Briggs, retired. What would you like them to say about you when you're gone?
I would hope that they would say that I'll be missed. He was a decent guy and he made a difference.
Can't ask for fairer than that. Thank you very much, Stuart. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on. The Cappuccino. Please make sure that you do follow Kevin. Speaker, he's an author, he's a consultant, and he's a veteran. He's got his own company, Pivotal Points. You also have your own Instagram account, don't you, Kevin? Which is, what's the tag on that?
And that's the only one I don't have typed at my desk. I got the others, but if they just looked up,
I
that
can
one
put it.
might be
Yep,
okay.
I can put it up in the links. That's no problems whatsoever. But please make sure you go and follow him. Go and watch his TED Talk. It's probably the most educational 10 minutes that you'll ever hear from a police officer. Make sure you buy the book. It is an absolute barnstormer. And like you say, like I said to you before, Kevin, thank you very much. Not just for your service to the people of America, but basically humanity in general. Because as I said at the very beginning, I don't think exponentially we can actually measure what you've done for humanity. I think in probably 10 or 15 years' time, when you're talking about those 200 people that you've helped, and that's actually 1500 people who maybe weren't here because they have done something that maybe they might have regretted. My hat goes off to you, sir.
Well, thank you, sir. Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show.
Thanks for listening. But please do Constable Brian and I a favor and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on the next Cappuccino podcast. Real people, real stories.